Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, if we live with social, political, and economic structures set up by and for only half the population, how can we tear them down to make room for more inclusive institutions? We'll spend this hour with Jennifer Palmieri, who was communications director for the 2016 Hillary Clinton campaign and the Obama White House. Palmieri's focus now is pointing out and correcting the gender imbalances that still exist at the highest ranks of American politics and business. We'll talk to her about her declaration of independence from the patriarchy after a short break. About imposter syndrome, right? It's the feeling successful people sometimes have that they don't actually belong where they are, that they've been promoted by mistake, feeling somehow less qualified or deserving than their colleagues, even if they are doing consistently stellar work. Imposter syndrome tends to be a particular problem for women in high places, and former White House communications director Jennifer Palmieri thinks she's figured out why. The modern workplace as we know it was built by men and for men. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. For much of her career, Palmieri recalls working longer and harder than most of her male colleagues, while often being promoted more slowly. Today, she has a different view. Women shouldn't have to be better than men to gain professional parity with them, because the way to achieve gender equality should be about changing gender-biased environments, not changing women. Jennifer Palmieri is president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund and former White House communications director for President Obama and director of communications for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Previously, she served as national press secretary for the John Edwards campaign and the Democratic Party. Her new book is called She Proclaims, Our Declaration of Independence from a Man's World. She joined me late last week via video chat, and today we're listening to our conversation.
Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you, Chris. It's really good to see you. Wish I was with you, but it's good to see you. Thank you for doing this.
Good to see you as well. You open the book with a scene around the kitchen table with these four women drafting what will become the really guidelines for the Declaration of Sentiments at the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention. This is 1848, when it's hard for me to even relate to this, I'm happy to say. Women had virtually no power under the law. What were some of the radical things that these women were asking for?
I find those women so inspiring because they were literally sitting around their kitchen table, had no power, and thought that if they wrote down what they believed they deserved and went and fought for it, that people would care, it would matter, and they could make a difference. And you can't feel that way unless you like just believe in your gut about yourself and your worth. And that's what I found inspiring about them. But women at that time couldn't own property. I mean, obviously they couldn't vote, but they couldn't own property. If they were married, they couldn't, if they worked outside the home, then their wages automatically went to their husband. They were second-class citizens. And the document that they ended up writing, the Declaration of Sentiments, was outrageously ambitious. They laid down all of their complaints of all the ways that they were treated lesser than men, and demanded immediate access to all the rights that men had. And I was just inspired by, you know, these particular women. You can just imagine them. It was a mom, her two grown daughters, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And thinking that that they believed in themselves made me think that that was a good sort of touchstone for women to start the book now, because I think we need a new paradigm for how we think about ourselves in the world. And I felt that that was the last time women had been that deliberate in writing down and seeking a different way.
So Jennifer, we've come a long way since 1848, but we haven't come all the way. What caused the impediments along the way?
So I think that for after women got the right to vote in 1920, that suffrage gave us the political professional tools to make our way into the political world and the professional workplace. And for decades, we made a lot of progress following by default, right? We were following the models created by men. And I know in my own experience, when I started working in the late 80s, I thought the women's rights movement was in the past. I thought that it was resolved. We had all the tools we needed to succeed. We might have to work harder than the men, but eventually we would get there. And then what I, you know, you look around and I saw in my own career, but then also just in the statistics, right? About 20 years ago, we stopped making progress in closing the gender gap. I mean, it's still getting smaller, but at a slower rate than before. Obviously, we don't have a woman president. Only 25% of Congress are women. 100 years later, that's kind of objectively, it's kind of crazy. And the realization I had was in trying to fit into a male-dominated workplace, I was trying to make myself useful, but I wasn't changing any kind of paradigms. And unless it's not enough to just let women into the game if we don't change any of the underlying rules of the game. And the truth is, it's not anybody's fault. It's not like I feel like men are trying to hold me back. That's never been my experience. But we are living in a world that was built by men for men, and women still struggle to break out of those confines. I never thought of myself as a woman working in a man's world. I never wanted to proclaim myself to be that, because I thought that meant you couldn't hack it, right? If you complained about being a woman in a man's world, it meant that you didn't really belong there. And I look at it differently now, because what, you know, I had thought I was doing great in the man's world. And then when I looked around, I realized I wasn't doing great. I was doing great making it run well for them. I mean, I think this will resonate with some women to hear people would say about me, well, Jennifer, she's a great number two, right? Jennifer, we couldn't possibly do it without her. We so rely on her. But Jennifer didn't become the White House chief of staff, a man who was younger than her did.
You and I are both Gen Xers, and it's sometimes hard to see the ways that we, the invisible generation, the ways that we've been socialized to feel like this is normal. You take us through this thought exercise, like what if every man in America had grown up with a family gathered around the TV all weekend watching women play sports? If every man in America grew up hearing State of the Union addresses exclusively from women? It's a really interesting thing to think about, because you start to realize how many things are not equivalent.
And I've had a lot of men comment to me that that was a very useful exercise for them to go through, particularly about sports. I mean, I love college football. I love the NFL. I really enjoy watching it too. But if women are wondering why we have a hard time, you know, I have not usually been a great advocate for myself, but, you know, advocating for promotions or raises or better deals, and you feel badly about it. But then when you think, if you look at objectively of all that we've internalized about how women are not valued as much as men, it makes a lot of sense. There are dozens of times each day we are told that we are not valued enough. You know, I'm sitting here in Nashville. Someone did a woman, Amanda Shires, who's a singer-songwriter here, did an analysis about country music radio stations, just listening to one herself to keep track of how many, you know, men to women artists were heard. And you could go hours without hearing a woman's voice. The stat has been 17-1 male artists heard to women artists. And, you know, country music television made an effort to change that. When they run videos, they're doing 1-for-1. But if you think about that, you know, 17-1, the male voices over the women, the fact that every time we've heard a president speak, it's a man's voice. We don't go on Friday night. The entire town doesn't turn out on Friday nights to watch the girls play soccer. It's to watch the boys play football. And you know, that is why. I mean, at the root of all that is women were not. Women just are not valued the same way that men are. That's sort of the root of the problem. And that's something that you have to exercise in, you know, power systems like marketplaces, for example, but also in your own head. This is why the American women's soccer team, which keeps beating, you know, which keeps winning World Cup titles, just can't stop winning World Cup titles, has to sue to be paid what they're worth, because the market was built to value men over women.
Even in terms of asking for the money that we're worth, you really frame this in terms of a feminist issue, which is not the way I had thought about it before. I was aware of the pay gaps, but I also know a lot of women are reluctant to say, wait, I'm not going to accept this amount of money. We say, thank you so much for giving me this job.
Totally. Yes. And I have been, and I think there's so many layers to it, because not only would I not want to argue for a raise for myself, it was a point of pride. For me that I didn't, right? I would tell myself, well, those things aren't important to me. Titles, salary. I just want to do a good job. I just want to be part of the team. And, you know, what I realized is I was settling for scraps, right? It was like I was settling for gestures. There's a chapter in the book that's about that, you know, it's like we're not going to settle for nice gestures anymore. And I think part of that was, it was sort of a defensive mechanism on my part, because I didn't want to be disappointed if I fought to get something and didn't get it. So I told myself it wasn't important to me. It actually is important to me, but also if women need an extra little push to go advocate for themselves, understand that if you undervalue yourself and what you're worth, you're undervaluing all women. That does not stay isolated into your case. It spills out and it hurts everybody.
I've been thinking a lot about reporting that's come out recently about millions of American women voluntarily leaving the workforce because of childcare issues during COVID. They're either having to educate their children or just take care of them during the day, and they can't afford to, you know, have someone come help them at this moment. What sort of long-term effect do you think this will have on the progress toward parity in the workplace?
I worry about it a lot. I think that everyone's attitude in this moment matters quite a bit. So what I think we need, you could say, and I have women, some of my own friends who say it's just too hard. I'm not going to get back to work. So women can either in this moment fall back a generation in terms of gains that have been made about women's equality in the workplace, or women can all band together and say, this pandemic what it's really done is just revealed these inequities. It's revealed all the ways that we don't value women's work, right? Because women are they've been laid off the most in the pandemic. They're also the most essential workers, and they're also in the lowest paid professions, okay? Well, if these professions are so essential, they should be better compensated. And so what I try to encourage women to do is, we should all band together and try to seek this kind of change. There's both laws that can assist here, childcare, for example, higher pay for teachers. But I think when you have a problem like this revealed, there is an opportunity to do something about it. And that is where our focus should be. But there is a real danger that we can slide back. It's precarious.
Another thing you write about here is boundaries. Especially earlier in your career, you would work longer and later than a lot of the men who were working alongside you. They would say, I've done my job, and then go home for the night. And you would say, I've done my job. This other thing is not my job, but it needs to get done. On the one hand, it feels like you really want to pitch in and give your all. Does that kind of willingness to do whatever is necessary actually create an impediment to, you know, upward mobility?
I finally made the realization that it was getting in my way, or at least it was getting the compunction to die for every ball, be the person that everyone can rely on. It is great up to a point, and it helped my career up to a point, but then it sort of stagnates because people think that they don't have to compensate you for, you know, in titles and money, because they know that they could just rely on you. And it shows a, you know, I don't mean to be harsh, it shows probably a deficiency in confidence. It's that may be also what it is conveying. That is why I know, like in my own life, I've had to shake that off.
My guest is former White House Communications Director for President Obama and current president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, Jennifer Palmieri. She joined me late last week via video chat to talk about her book, She Proclaims, Our Declaration of Independence from a Man's World. We'll be back after a short break. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is former White House Communications Director for President Obama and current president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, Jennifer Palmieri. She joined me last week via video chat to talk about her book, She Proclaims, Our Declaration of Independence from a Man's World. Let's return now to the conversation.
I want to talk about this sort of likability trap. You worked for Hillary Clinton, a candidate that for whatever reason, a lot of people felt like they just did not care for. You know, mm-hmm. some people have a kind of more electric presence than others, but I don't remember people saying, Al Gore's really smart, but I'm not voting for him because there's just something about him that I don't care for.
Yeah. There's just something about her I don't like. Is it was something we heard so often on the Clinton campaign. It became an acronym, T-S-A-H-I-J-D-L. You know, it was just this, always this amorphous, yeah, I don't know. And we pushed people, what is it? I don't know. And I don't think, and I think it does come down to gender in this way. I mean, first of all, people cannot like Hillary Clinton. It's fine. You can have legitimate reasons or disagreeing with her. But it was just everywhere, this really vague, there's just something about her. I don't trust, I don't like. And what I think it is, what I've come to realize is when we fall into intangibles like that, where people are like, I don't know, gender, race is probably at play. It doesn't mean everybody who doesn't like Hillary is sexist. It's just, I think for all of her adult life, whenever she was in the public eye, she was always pushing the boundaries, stepping outside of the role women normally play, right? She was the first, when her husband was governor of Arkansas, she was a lawyer, didn't change her name. She was the first lady who worked on policy, ran for the Senate. Not super radical, but just a little vexing. And we don't recognize her. There's not a model in our heads for how we can think about her. I didn't appreciate prior to working for her presidential campaign how important these models of what a leader looks like are and how they do hold women back. So it's like there's something confounding, vexing. I don't really recognize her. I don't get it. There's something about her I just don't like. And then I also had a realization after, it was still during the 2016 campaign, but at the very end where I thought this is sort of a thunderbolt. I thought what we have been trying to do is prove to everyone she can do the job the same way it's always been done, right? Which is following a man's model. It's like trying to jam her into this ill-fitting suit. And I thought, well, no wonder people think she's inauthentic.
I was really interested when you were writing about doing interviews earlier in your career as White House Communications Director. I find you a really good interview, but you say that you struggled initially because you would go on these cable news shows and want the host, the interviewer, to feel heard and understood when they weren't necessarily approaching you with the same grace.
I think women can relate to this. Someone asks you a question and you want to allow like, oh, I hear you. I understand your point. I understand where you're coming from. We might want to repeat the question back to them. And what it means in terms of politics is that you're sort of buying into the premise of the question, which is something you're never supposed to do in political communications.
Which is why politicians are hard to interview.
Yeah, right. So what I found I would do is I would sort of buy into the premise of the question, and then I would hem and haw, and it would take me a while to get back to the point that I wanted to make. And I had a realization that for most of my life, I've been having two conversations in my head. And I find a lot of women say this resonates with them. One is what you want to say in response to a question. And then, but then before you speak, you check it against how you will be challenged when you say what you're going to say, and if you can defend it once you are challenged. And after you reconcile the two, then you speak. So I think this is why women sometimes say, oh, well, she hems and haws. And I think it's that process that you're going through. It's like, well, I want to say this, but I know they're going to come back. They're going to push back on me. And I don't know how I'm going to defend it. And sometimes if I didn't know how I was going to defend what I wanted to say, I just wouldn't say it. And it's not a small thing to not say what you think.
We're about to have, once again, three women serving on the U.S. Supreme Court. I'll note that that's, you know, 50% the number of men serving on the Supreme Court. And of course, these women come from different ideological backgrounds. But you quote a study in the book, I think from Northeastern University, that finds that male Supreme Court justices interrupt their female colleagues twice as often, more than that, significantly more often. It's hard to believe that, you know, these are women at the highest level of their professions. What is going on there?
This story is amazing because it's not, Chris, it's not just that the male justices were interrupting the female justices. It's that the lawyers, right, the solicitors before the court who were arguing their case that the justices would decide, they were interrupting the female justices. One year they found that the most common interruption of any, you know, of all for the entire court was Justice Sonia Sotomayor, the only woman of color on the court, being interrupted by solicitors presenting cases before the court. And the study concluded, and I just love this conclusion, that there was no status high enough at which women would not be interrupted. And in this case, they found that the female solicitors, the women lawyers presenting before the court, were not interrupting anyone. It was the male solicitors. But I do find in real life that, you know, this is just something else we've internalized, women and men both. We hear men's voices and we treat that with more seriousness than we do when we hear a woman's voice. So women will interrupt other women. Men will interrupt other women. It's something that we both do. There's a sort of an affiliated phenomenon that the Harvard Business Review has decreed to be appropriating. This is when a woman has an idea and then no one reacts in the meeting. And then a man says the same thing a few minutes later and everything is like, oh, that Jim is so smart. And this would happen to Hillary Clinton on her campaign. We'd be in a meeting, Hillary would say something, people wouldn't really react. One of our male pollsters would have the same idea a few minutes later, and everybody would say, oh, this is great. And Hillary would look at me like, so I would say, yes, I think that's the point that the secretary was making a few minutes ago. And then the men would be horrified and they're like, oh my God, you're right. They don't intend to do it. It's just how we have, doesn't have to continue, but how we have been wired. Happens to all women.
So I wish I could have had your live commentary during the vice presidential debate between Senator Harris and Vice President Pence. She was interrupted a lot and she didn't take it. She said, I'm speaking, and sort of waited until she could be acknowledged to continue, acknowledged and heard. What did you make of that?
That was progress. That's what I made of it. It was real progress because she, not only did she not allow him, she said, I'm speaking, Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking. And then she waits. She doesn't fight him to talk over him. She waits until he backs down. So I think a couple things here. One, Kamala Harris, you know, when she was named as the running mate, there was concern that she was going to be subjected to a lot of sexist and gender bias, you know, coverage. There are definitely elements of that, but in her own interactions, she is able to defend herself really well. And I think that's because as a biracial woman coming up in politics, she's had to be very clear about who she is and defending herself for a very long time. It's not anything new to Kamala Harris. And she's good at it. But I also think that, you know, in the 4 years since Hillary ran, we're just more, all of us are just more aware of how women are hurt, you know, or hurt or not hurt and treated. And, don't, you know, and even Mike Pence, you know, even Mike Pence backs down, but it was such a good moment. And it's just, it was really heartening to see 4 years later, that kind of thing happen and it be received well in the public. Not that I think if Hillary had done something like that 4 years ago, not that Hillary's the big victim, but it just was a different time. It would have been, that would not have been received as a good moment. It would have been her being snippy, right? Something like that. But I was loved it. It was great.
So I, as a white person, am still having to learn to recognize my white privilege in all the places it exists, because by its nature, that privilege was invisible to me for a long time. I think male privilege is invisible to a lot of men. What can we do as women to make that privilege that they have visible to them, especially to the guys who really don't want to be biased against women, who don't want to contribute to this, but maybe can't even see all the ways that our society really enables that?
Yeah, and I find this a lot with men, because they will say, some of the men in my family will say, you know, I worked really hard to get where I am. This wasn't just handed to me. And I say, yes, I know that, but a woman who worked just as hard as you would not have gotten as far as you did. Certainly true for people of color. You know, that I find that is a big thing with some of my white male friends, and yeah, you know, to make the point that it's not that you didn't work hard or that everything was handed to you. It wasn't. You had to work really hard for it. But I did work really hard too, and I didn't get. It took me a lot longer to get where you are. And I find there are two chapters in the book that also helps, you know, there's what you mentioned before, where to imagine that if women had run the world, and we valued women the same, you know, more as we value men, how would men feel? Would they be insecure and have struggle with their self-confidence? I think they would. If all the presidents had been men, if all the presidents had been women, we heard a male politician's voice, we'd be like, he sounds like my dad. I can't vote for that guy. He sounds like my dad.
What a grating voice, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so grating, or just, wow, he's just all this, it's just really off-putting. It's so big and loud. And I want something soothing and melodious. I want to hear that kind of voice. And then the other chapter that I have is about being a good partner, and just to point out to men, here are things that you could do. Hiring is a good example. You know, it's not enough to just consider women when you're hiring, and it's if you consider a man and a woman, but you continue to default for male candidates because they're just a better fit, you have to push through that, because of course they're a better fit. We have seen them in the workplace for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's what we imagine when we imagine leaders, people working. We understand, like an ambitious young guy, we can project how well they will do in the future. We can't do that with women. If it, you know, he's just a better fit, well, maybe it would be better for your organization if you had something a little different. A woman may do the job differently, but it doesn't mean the man's better than her. And if you want to break, and most of the men I know anyway, they want women to do better. They want, if they're a white man, they want people of color to do better. They want to help figure out how you get out from under these power systems. And it's like, don't start a company with three white guys. Don't do it. Every time I see two entrepreneurs on television, it's always two white guys. Don't do it. Bring women, bring people of color in on the ground floor. If you don't bring them in on the ground floor, you're going to, like, this culture gets set. It's really important that it starts beginning.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd.
Another thing you bring up here that affects women's lifelong self-confidence in many situations is this reality of being socialized to constantly defend ourselves against the possibility of violence. And I have to tell you, mm-hmm. my daughters are millennials. They're Gen Z kids. And they were the first ones to say to me, this is ridiculous. Why is the world this way? As I was teaching them all these lessons about make sure you have your keys in your hand and your pepper spray. I think I hadn't realized until recently the way that fear for my physical safety, just, you know, walking across a darkened parking lot when I am working late at night, might affect my behavior in other situations, my self-confidence.
Yeah, I did. It's not really something that had occurred to me either until and I write about this in the book, that during when Me Too was really exploding, in the fall of 2017, I was talking to a male friend who'd worked for Hillary Clinton for a long time, you know, really progressive guy. And he said to me, wow, it never occurred to me that women feel fear in their daily lives. And I thought, what do you mean that's never occurred to you? And then I thought, what would it feel like to not feel fear? And he, and to his credit, he was sort of appalled that it had never occurred to him that that was women's daily life. And you just, and then I thought, well, no wonder he walks around with so much confidence, as if the world, everything's going to work out. And, you know, he doesn't have the worry, the fear, the nagging thing in the back of your mind that something's going to go wrong, or that you're under constant surveillance or being watched, that of course you're going to go through life. Of course things are going to work out for you because you have that kind of attitude that everything is going to be fine because that's all that you know. And I just you realize how profoundly that can shape you to live in fear. But it is great that your daughters don't see it objectively. As something that they shouldn't have to expect. I mean, there's so many things, you know, we expect to feel fear. We expect to have to defend ourselves in a way that men don't. We expect that men are going to do better than us. These are all things I went in expecting. There was a Pew did a research about, did a study about how different demographics think whether or not they think men have it easier in America. And the demographic most likely to believe that men had it easier than women were millennial and Gen Z, millennial and Gen Z women. And I just love it's not Gen X, it's not the baby boomers, it's the younger women that see it. And that makes me really hopeful that they're not going to tolerate that. And that is why, you know, I feel like I have ground to make up for, because for decades when I was in the workplace, I thought everything was great and I didn't really do anything to further women's equality. So I feel like I'm making up for lost time, and desperate that your daughters don't learn the kind of things that we internalized. That's why I wrote the book.
My guest is former White House Communications Director for President Obama and current president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, Jennifer Palmieri. She joined me late last week via video chat to talk about her book, She Proclaims, Our Declaration of Independence from a Man's World. We'll be back after a short break. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is former White House Communications Director for President Obama and current president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, Jennifer Palmieri. She joined me last week via video chat to talk about her book, She Proclaims, Our Declaration of Independence from a Man's World. Let's return now to the conversation.
What does it mean for women to help one another? What practical forms can that take?
Support other women. So support women that you work with, try to get more women into your workplace, try to get more women of color in particular into your workplace if you're a white woman. I I did make this a priority in the Obama White House, where our, even though we had, you know, we worked for the first Black president, our communications office was not diverse enough. And I was able to, I was able to bring in, you know, 7 young Black women eventually was what our, as part of our staff. And I found that, you know, those women continue to mentor me, support me, like it all rebounds back to you. I did have a sense earlier in my career, I always wanted to be a good sister, right? You want to be good to other women. But I thought, if I help this woman, she may outshine me. I may be hiring my replacement. I would try to do it anyway to kind of put that aside, but I did have that nagging doubt. And I've thought a lot about what that's about. And I think that, you know, when you think that only a few women are able to succeed, what you're really saying is we don't belong here. What you're really saying is the professional workplace is for men. And like, there's only women succeeding as the exception and not the rule. And there's social research that shows this. Once there's more women in a workplace, once you get to over 30%, the 30% tipping theory, that's when it can really take off. Then the women that are in the workplace don't feel tokenized at all. They're just able to like do their jobs and do well. So, you know, if I had one piece of advice for my younger self, it would be, women are not your competition, they are your sisters. And I certainly, you know, so I think you can support them in the workplace, you can support people in your own family, you can support women in your community, but there's, you know, the same is true for being a better ally to people of color. It's great to protest, it's great to vote, but what are you doing in your own life? But if women could shed the notion that we are in competition with each other for a finite amount of success that is available to women, I think that I really believe that's sort of what keeps a cap on women from being able to succeed. Crabs in a bucket, just like pulling each other down. Of course, you're going to perpetuate systems that keep women out of power. You believe that.
So, of course, there are only 24 hours in a day, and we already know that you have long sort of worked longer than a lot of your colleagues. But I'm curious about whether you've learned anything about mentoring young men to be good and supportive and capable colleagues to their female associates.
That's a great question. I do have, I mean, honestly, I've made a much bigger priority of mentoring young women that either are in the workplace that I would be in, or young women reporters, because I, you know, work a lot in politics, and that's a tough business, particularly with social media. They're subjected to a lot of abuse, doubts, criticisms that their male colleagues are not. I haven't made it a priority to mentor young men, but I have found many who either seek me out or surprise me with their questions or their awareness in a very positive way. I have a lot of nephews. they're great at this and asking questions about it, but then also in the workplace. And I will point out to them, it, you know, like these things, that it's, you know, you're working hard, you're working, and I'm sensitive to this. It is still, white men in America still have an advantage, but they have less an advantage than they have ever had in our history, right? So I know that, you know, looking at it this way, most power is consolidated in the hands of white men, but that doesn't mean that, you know, but the vast majority of white men don't have a lot of power. So I'm sensitive to that too, in that these are young men that are working hard, trying to be good allies, not feeling like they're holding people back, but I still want them to be aware you still have this advantage. You still need to listen more. You need to be more aware of that. Not everyone's experience is the same. My experience is that young men are pretty open to that. They want to know that. They want to be good allies.
You knew Monica Lewinsky a little bit before the Bill Clinton sex scandal. Years later, you happened to run into her again by chance. What did you want to say to her?
I said that I was sorry. I was just sorry for everything that happened to her, that her life got, you know, she just was collateral damage in a big political fight that was about men in power. She had been my intern in the White House. That was how she met. You know, not like it was my fault, but I did sort of set in motion these events that led to her life exploding. And the way that, you know, the way that we all saw it did. And after, you know, while in 1998, when I just remember, you know, was not, she was no longer in the White House. I was not in touch with her, but just seeing how she was so hunted, mocked, just destroyed, how watching, I remember watching her mom come out of an interview with the FBI and her mother looked physically broken. She was just like hunched over, like she might actually collapse. And it was just wrenching to watch. I used to have these nightmares that I wouldn't know, I would see her, run into her and didn't know what to say to her. And then 20 years later I did. And was able to say just so sorry. I mean, this is the way her life got defined by this in a way that Bill Clinton's life did not. That I could tell it was, you know, nobody, something that I don't think that was something that she had heard before from somebody who worked for the Clintons. And, you know, it is, would I see the difference now if you look at Me Too and how this has evolved over the last 20 years? Is it used to be with like sex and politics, it's always been a thing, but it was like, well, what does this behavior say about the man? And there was never a focus on what did it do to the woman. And you know, that's what's changed. That's what's changed now. You saw that even reflected in the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. You know, he still got confirmed, but Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's heard we were considered, you know, the consideration was about how this incident impacted her, not like a political football. So I see that as some kind of progress too.
Behind closed doors, I'm curious about whether people in politics share the same sorrow over just how ugly politics has become in this country, over the lack of decorum, over the perception that all that matters is that you are on a team and your opponents are on a team and you are always playing to win. I think about, you know, the advice given to married couples, like, don't fight to win. You have to fight to sort of solve this thing. And I feel like we are fighting to win and we are, you know, careening toward divorce right now. Is that a sentiment that people working in politics today share, but just don't know how to fix?
Yes, it is. You know, some of the work I'm doing now, I'm on this show on Showtime called The Circus, and it's like a weekly political documentary, and I'm sort of the Democrat on the show, and then there's this guy, Mark McKinnon, who worked for President Bush, longtime Republican strategist. And, you know, partly through Mark, partly through this show, I've had a lot of exposure to, there's Republicans that are not supporting President Trump, that very much, I mean, it's the question of their life, right? It is like, it's what they wake up fretting about. It's something I think a lot about. I got into politics because I love the idea that people can band together and change things. I think most people who get into politics do it with that kind of aspiration on either side. And the, you know, I hear it from the Trump supporters in my family too, like, wow, we're just so divided. Is there a way that we can come back? I don't hear it enough at the leadership level, but it is something that most people in politics, and it's a good question because I think people think that it's all just, you know, cynical and cutthroat and about, you know, who can actually win. But I think it eats at most of us.
I want to talk just a little bit about ageism here. Why is it still considered more of a liability for a woman to be over a certain age than a man?
Oh, because we have an expiration date on us based off our looks, right? So, and it is, I feel I think like it's very rebellious. I love saying I'm 53 years old. I love saying that I'm over 50. I turned 50 right a week after Hillary lost the 2016 race. So that was really, it was like pretty brutal fall. But I have found that I'm doing my best work now. I have found that I've always felt like I'm somebody who is talented, but you have potential, but you need to have knowledge and experience in order to take that potential and really put it to the best use. And I have found that even just saying that out loud changes things. I mean, sure, I know that ageism exists for men too. There's no question it hits women harder, but I look around, you know, Kamala Harris is in her mid-50s. There are a lot of women reporters. Kara Swisher comes to mind, who's just killing it. The New York Times and other outlets that she's got podcasts everywhere, and she's a huge voice. She's matters so much in Silicon Valley. You know, she's in her late 50s. The entertainment world is, you know, you see actresses that have moved on to directing, but are also still acting. Like, you know, they're just, it's just changing everywhere. And I find it just how you project yourself in the world, and if you embrace your age and just assert it as giving you experience and wisdom that it does and making you better, people, you know, it makes a difference. People buy into it. I say I'm 53, and women who are 50 look at me like, you can say that?
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd.
Yeah. The last thing I want to ask you about is that you state unequivocally here that we need to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, which is something that I think you and I remember from childhood,
yeah,
in a different form than it was in the late 1970s.
It was, I remember this, like my first experience with right-wing false disinformation was in, I was going to Catholic school in South Carolina, and the ERA was still a thing. And one of the boys in my class said, well, if there's the ERA, boys and girls have to use the same bathroom. It's like my first experience with disinformation.
It's all the bathroom, right?
Yeah, it's all bathrooms, right? So I think, you know, this was in writing this book, and I don't write too much about ERA, but I did read a couple of books about the ratification process when I was writing She Proclaims, just to get a handle on, you know, there was suffrage. That was a time where women came together, you know, some fits and starts, some not great stories about particularly involving race, that color that history. But eventually, after almost 100 years of effort, 72 years of effort, they got the right to vote. And then there was another effort to get past the Equal Rights Amendment. Women fought each other and it died. I'm sitting in Nashville, Tennessee, and Nashville is where the 19th Amendment, the amendment that where women won suffrage, was ratified, and it won by one vote. And if Tennessee had not ratified it, it was on the verge of dying. It could have easily gone the other way, as it did with the ERA. And when women pit ourselves against each other, we hold ourselves back. I think. Yeah, I am not an expert on the ERA by any means, but I think having our rights ratified in the Constitution is an important act. And I know that just the process, going through this process, would in and of itself be a big education effort, and that will have change. I mean, I've worked in politics long enough to know that just having an issue on the ballot, having things be debated, it would spur more conversations like this, make people more aware of, you know, of gender bias, how it holds women back, how they can confront it in their own lives. And I feel like that's a really valuable thing.
Jennifer, thank you for making time for us today.
Thank you, Chris. It was really great to speak with you.
Jennifer Palmieri is president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund and former White House Communications Director for President Obama and Director of Communications for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Her new book is called She Proclaims, Our Declaration of Independence from a Man's World. You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.